and not have heartburn and not have the food sit in your stomach and not have to take Nexium and all that purple pill that is so heavily advertised. When you do that, you're not being, I'm not saying you shouldn't take the medications and you're uncomfortable. All what I'm saying is please recognize that when you find these natural alternatives to invigorate, you're being kind to your unborn baby. That music tells me I have to take leave. Please join me next Wednesday. Until then, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
Time of year again when we start thinking about the stuff we need to buy for all our friends and loved ones for the holidays. It's enough to stress anybody out. So how about giving something to WBAI, your community radio station that's been here for you every day of the year? Hi, I'm Mario Murillo, interim program director of WBAI. Think about it. What better way to close out 2014 than to give a tax-deductible contribution to the station and join the many listeners who have already become buddies of WBAI in recent months? It's really easy to make a safe online e-pledge. Just go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org and follow the easy steps. Whatever the size of your gift, $10, $100, $1,000, your contribution will go a long way in keeping WBAI on the air as we head into 2015. That's give2wbai.org. Join us this holiday season and release the stress of all that shopping for things that you or your friends really don't need.
Have you heard about WBAI's discount program offering you savings on your prescribed medications? You can download your free discount card from WBAI.org. Every time you use it, you will save on your cost. And at the same time, you will be helping to support WBAI Radio. There is no extra cost, pledge, or subscription required. WBAI will receive $1.75 from NDC every time you use the card. Your collective participation in this program will help build a healthier WBAI. Check it out on WBAI.org and download your card today. You're listening to WBAI Radio in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with Paulette Spencer, and you are listening to our interim program, Earth at Midnight. And I want to say hello to Paulette. She's going to be featuring a very special guest this day.
Yes, good evening, Kathy.
Good evening.
And we're quite proud to be able to present an evening with Mr. Ray McGovern, who is who works with Tell the World, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. Mr. McGovern served as an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and then served as a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. Mr. McGovern's duties included chairing the national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. In January 2003, Mr. McGovern helped create the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war in Iraq. And so with that introduction, I'm quite proud to speak to Mr. McGovern. Are you there?
I am. Good evening, or good morning.
Good morning. And thank you so much for taking this time to speak with us live, Mr. McGovern.
My pleasure.
Last week, I sort of mentioned that there was this release of the report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence regarding the enhanced interrogation techniques. And I wanted to spend some time speaking to you about it and your sense of what the significance is of the discussions that are going on now. I was able to listen to your exchange with Peter Hoekstra on the Central China TV station. And I also listened to Dick Cheney's interview on Meet the Press last Sunday, in which both Hoekstra and Cheney defended the practices. And I wanted just to get a sense of what you think of that in the larger picture.
Sure. Well, Paulette, it's been an extraordinary week. To have the vice president defend torture and say he'd do it again. And for me to have a chance to confront one of the few people in Washington who could have and was duty-bound under his duties under the Constitution to oversee CIA and make sure that these abuses didn't happen. He, too, is defending them, singing the same tune as Cheney. And luckily, I was right there next to him and could ask him some questions and offer him some outs. To say that he didn't really know the extent of it, but no, he said, I know, I checked with my staff, and they tell me that the Senate Intelligence Committee report, we knew 90 to 95% of the stuff in there. Yeah, we know, we all couldn't believe it. So you're admitting that? Yeah, of course, yeah, well, so torture. No, enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, probably some in your audience, at least, don't know the derivation of the phrase enhanced interrogation techniques. But actually, people might be surprised to know that it's a literal translation of Verschärfte Vernehmung, which is the German words for Verschärfte, sharpened or enhanced, and Vernehmung is what they use for interrogation. And that is the heading over the chapter in the Gestapo handbook for torture techniques. Verschärfte Vernehmung. So, I'm not suggesting that the perpetrators or the devisers of these things looked directly at the Gestapo manual, but isn't it ironic that the same words were used, and not only that, Paulette, but the same techniques. So after World War II, when this manual was captured, we had the actual techniques listed under Verschärfte Vernehmung, and they turned out to be pretty much identical to what the U.S. was doing under George Bush and Dick Cheney, with a few enhancements. Okay, so enhanced the FAFSA for them. And yeah, that's sort of an indictment. And we thought we were finished with that. And after the war, of course, countries got together and devised and passed, and we ratified and signed the UN Convention Against Torture, which says explicitly nothing, not war, not rumors of war, not insurrection, not terrorism, nothing can be an extenuating circumstance to allow people to violate this convention. Now, Ronald Reagan, to his credit, pushed the U.S. to sign it. The Senate agreed in 1984, so was Bill Clinton, signed it. So, you know, there it is. We are bound by that convention under international law, also bound by the Geneva Conventions. But when George Bush said he wanted to torture people, then the head of the CIA saluted smartly, went out and found some thugs that would do it for him. A terrible chapter in our nation's history.
As you bring up Ronald Reagan, I did a bit of research as I wanted to get a sense of what the political climate was like at the time that he signed off on the Convention Against Torture. And I learned that at that point in his administration, there were terms used to describe critics of U.S. foreign policy, especially in regard to the Cold War at the time. And I came across the term moral equivalence.
Yeah, right. I know what you're referring to. Yeah, Ronald Reagan had this strange idea that these thugs that they hired to overthrow the Nicaraguan government, or at least to try to do so, that they were the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. These are the people who are destroying life, liberty, and everything else in Nicaragua, and running drugs into Los Angeles and other major cities in our country. You know, I mean, Ronald Reagan said a lot of heavily ironic things. This has to rank up among the top of that list.
Because what I understood a bit further was that to a certain extent that sense of moral equivalence kind of morphed into perceptions of American exceptionalism.
Well, yeah, you know, we really have to credit, if that's the right word, credit a Democratic administration for the claim that the U.S. is the sole indispensable country in the world. Now, you know, we had this manifest destiny sort of idea, and the first people, the first whites that came to these shores, of course, thought themselves very special, biblically inspired, and so forth. But not until Madeleine Albright came in as the Secretary of State for Bill Clinton. Not until she came in did we have this sort of codified in her and other speeches where we are the indispensable country in the world. And, you know, as I go around talking in colleges and sometimes high schools, I have a little fun. You know, I say, do we still teach what antonyms are? And usually there's one or two there and say, yeah, I know. What is it? It's opposite, right? So, all right, so we're the sole indispensable country in the world. Now, what's the opposite of indispensable? And they sort of scratch their heads, and somebody says, well, dispensable? Say, yeah, right. So, by definition, all other countries in the world are what? They say, dispensable? I say, yeah. If we're the sole, you know, it's simply a syllogism, or as night follows the day. So if that's the way we look at other countries, well, number one, we don't buy any goodwill by looking at it that way. We have been since the end of World War II, when we actually entered the international stage. And, you know, people don't really understand where we were at that point. Let me just take you back to 1946, 47, 48. The war had been won. Russia had been destroyed. Germany had been destroyed. Most of France had been destroyed. England suffered heavy losses. We emerged then as the sole superpower in the world. It was then, not later. We were challenged by the Soviet Union for several decades. But we adopted a policy right after the war. And I have the policy document. It was about the Policy Planning Council of the State Department, newly established under the National Security Act of 1947. And it was written by George Kennan, former ambassador to the Soviet Union, a real specialist and a good one on Russia and the Soviet Union. And what did it say? Well, it said, here we are. We're only 6.3% of the world's population, but we control 50% of the world's natural resources. So, in developing our policy, we can't be, you know, we can't be enslaved to concepts of human rights or altruistic notions like that. No, our policy has to be devised in such a way as to maintain this disequilibrium, this lack of balance. In other words, we need to do what we have, we have to do to maintain our share of the world's wealth, which happens to be 50% at present, 1948, and even though we only represent 6.3% of the world's population. Well, okay, and that's what our policies were aimed to do. And, of course, when the upstart Iranian freely elected for the first time Premier Mossadegh in Iran, and when he was elected and said, you know, I think that, yeah, this sounds like a good idea. I think maybe the Iranian people should get most of the wealth that comes from the oil underneath their soil. And then, of course, the British Secret Service and the CIA said, well, we have to deal with this kind of upstart. And they overthrew him. Everyone knows that. That happened in 1953. So when Kennan finishes up this little paragraph in his Policy Planning Council paper, he says, we're going to have to resort by and by to hard power, not soft power. We're going to have to recognize that because we can't be diverted by altruistic notions of civil rights and of human rights, is the way he puts it. I was shocked to read that, and I didn't learn that in college or in graduate school. I learned that much later, but it does sort of throw a light on what U.S. policy has been and continues to be, and helps people understand why it was that we went into Iraq in 2003.
Just to return to the way that the UN Convention on Torture was interpreted a certain way by certain attorneys general that led to the green light for the powers that be to torture these persons under U.S. Watch over the period between 2002 and 2009 is covered in this report. I wanted to ask, what were the changes to the interpretation that permitted that torture or the enhanced interrogation techniques to take place?
Mm-hmm. Well, these were devised under Reagan. His people sort of said, well, now, wait a second, we've got these techniques that can be sort of bloodless. You know, they're sort of psychological or mental or, you know, techniques that don't show scars. And so let's see if we can do the equivalent of a signing statement. You know, presidents often put a little signing statement on legislation that they're signing rather than vetoing, by saying, well, this is what this means and this is what this doesn't mean. The Reagan administration proposed language very much in that sense, and distinguished between physical torture and mental torture. That's a sort of short way of saying it. And the mental, they kind of flip-flopped and said, well, maybe, you know, mental shouldn't be included here. And so the reservation really pretty much says, well, you know, we don't buy that mental torture can be that prohibited, and that, of course, allowed the terrific research that had been done by universities as well as intelligence agencies to have some prospect of being implemented. So, long story short, when Clinton came in, he took those reservations lock, stock, and barrel. He didn't change a semicolon. And they went along with the ratification of the treaty. So the smart lawyers, and they're always real smart, they cite that as giving the United States some sort of exemption so that we can torture people mentally, but not physically. Now, that doesn't stand up because there are U.S. statutes that also prohibit this kind of torturous behavior, mean or degrading or inhuman treatment. And so it's one of these semantic things, one of these things that smart lawyers, and I use smart with quotes around it, lawyers with a brief to allow these kinds of things, the kinds of semantics that they use as loopholes to, quote, justify, end quote, torture techniques. Now, Paula, let me just take one step back here.
Sure.
As you might be able to tell, I feel really strongly about this stuff. I was an Army officer 50 years ago, and I went through all the training, and I knew how interrogations had to be conducted, and I knew how I was to act if I were captured. You know, it just pains me greatly to see the U.S. military pretty much corrupted by this kind of attitude that, well, no, we're preeminent, we're indispensable, and we can do what we want. Other countries really shouldn't torture, but we can. And what I like to say is that everything is being argued these days. Is being argued from a utilitarian point of view. In other words, this doesn't work. Just don't you do turn up any good information on that. Well, I'd like to address that later. But first off, and far more important in my view, in my moral universe, is the fact that torture is just dead wrong, okay? When I studied ethics in college, I went to Fordham University in New York, and We had at it, you know. We try to develop categories of actions and rubrics to figure out what category they went in. And there was one category I remember very distinctly. It was called intrinsic evil, okay? Always wrong, never permitted. And into that category was rape, slavery, and torture. In other words, it was beyond anyone's ken, and certainly beyond anyone's moral right, to, quote, authorize, end quote, somebody to rape someone else, or to authorize someone to enslave someone else, and to authorize, and that's the word they've been using down here in Washington. We have to have the necessary authorities so that we can, so to authorize someone to torture another. Human beings don't do those things to other human beings. That is clear. You don't have to be a believer in Almighty God or anything like that. Humans know that they don't do that to another human being unless they are taught to regard the other human being as subhuman, literally. So what I'm saying here is to me, very important that once you start, you know, getting down the next level, whether it works or not, well, that's you should have that conversation. But before you talk about whether torture works or not, and this is hardly ever adverted to in the conversations today, you need to just say, well, is it moral? Is it the way a human being should act toward another human being? And so what I'm saying here is that torture is not wrong because there are laws against it, because there's a UN Convention against Torture that we signed on to. That's not why torture is wrong. It's the other way around, okay? There are laws, and there's the UN Convention against Torture because it's wrong. Because countries recognized it to be wrong after the Gestapo finally vanished from the face of the earth, thank goodness. So that's in my view, in my worldview, that's an important distinction. If you come from the moral kind of universe that says, well, you know, you can authorize terrible things like rape or slavery or torture, but then you're in a completely different moral category than I am. But I'm still willing to, you know, to engage in conversation as to whether it works. But I always try to set the stage by saying, look, I don't think we should be having this conversation prima facie because torture is so wrong, recognized to having been wrong. And then laws against it, not because somebody dreamed up the laws, but because it was wrong and they needed to codify the wrongness of this procedure.
Thank you. One other question I have is, therefore, what do you make of the reaction that you've seen from persons such as Dick Cheney and Pete Hoekstra towards torture?
Well, Paulette, they are arguably war criminals. Take Cheney, for example. He was the... what's the word? The eminence grise, you know, the person behind Bush and the others when they decided to make war in a country that posed no threat to us at all. That was Iraq, of course. What's it been? 11 years almost. 11 years more. It was March the 20th, 2003, that we attacked Iraq. Now, that attack on Iraq, together with our British friends, is properly described as a war of aggression, the kind of war that the UN Charter strictly forbade. There was no imminent threat to us, and the Security Council had not ruled that the war was possible. So it's against the UN law. But more important, it fit the description of this war of aggression defined at Nuremberg. Okay, so a year after the end of World War II, and it was defined very carefully, and this is what the definition is still. A war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole, period, end quote. Accumulated evil. Well, think torture. Think kidnapping, think putting people in black prisons without telling their wives or their children or much less the Red Cross where they are, how long they've been there. Think of all those things. And you see what Nuremberg meant when it talked about a war of aggression embracing this accumulated evil of the whole. And so that's what Dick Cheney and George Bush are guilty of. And there's no doubt in my mind that qualifies. Well, I just told you what Nuremberg said. They call it the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only in this manner of accumulated evil. So Dick Cheney can't risk leaving this country, nor can George W. Bush, to go to any place other than maybe Canada or Mexico with an army of Secret Service agents protecting them. Why? Well, because our president, President Barack Obama, has refused to discharge his constitutional duty to see that the law is faithfully enforced. He has famously said, oh, we're going to look forward. We're not going to look backward. And so he's let these people escape accountability. Fortunately, there's a provision in international law called universal jurisdiction. And this is a principle that allows other countries, actually requires other countries. If a fellow named Cheney shows up in Paris, they are allowed under international law to detain him, to apprehend him, to question him, and to bring him to trial for war crimes. That's the way it works. Now, people say, oh, that's the government. That's not going to happen. And then I say, it's already happened. George Bush was supposed to attend a big gala celebration in Geneva 3 years ago, and he was going to give a big speech. And he was toiling over a speech, and then, unfortunately, someone told him what the Center for Constitutional Rights and several of its allies in Europe were prepared to do if he showed up in Switzerland. They were prepared to serve papers of the Swiss authorities and to detain him under the principle of the universal jurisdiction. As soon as he heard that, he canceled his plans, and because of technical problems, I don't know how he really explained it, but it was very clear that he was too afraid to go to Switzerland, even though he presumably would have brought an army of Secret Service agents with him. Now, did it happen to anybody else? Yeah, it happened to Rumsfeld a year before. Rumsfeld was a big conference in Paris, okay, and he's in the U.S. Embassy, and then he gets word some French citizen has filed papers with the procurator in Paris saying that Rumsfeld is a war criminal. He should be detained and questioned and so forth. And Rumsfeld, out the back door, scooting out to Charles de Gaulle Airport and getting the next plane home. So this is very real. There are a lot of CIA agents that have been convicted by the Italian court. And they can't risk going out of the country either. So that's small solace for what I think these people need to account for and the penalty that they should be subjected to. But at least it's something. And we'll see if anything else can happen. But that's, you know, the international, the countries abroad, to our shame, are the ones that can hold these people accountable in a way that our president, who, by the way, in my view, is afraid of the CIA, afraid of NSA, afraid of our security services, in a way that our president won't do because he thinks it's too risky. And we have reached one heck of a pass when, you know, 27-year alumnus from the CIA hears himself saying that. But I've been saying that. I believe that to be the case. And if he was going to be so afraid, you know, I really think he would have done us a favor by not running for president.
What a statement. We're just going to take a moment to do a station ID.
Yeah, I just want people to know you're listening to WBAI Radio in New York, 99.5 FM on your dial, and WBAI.org on the web.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. McGovern. You mentioned war of aggression. I can't help but ask this question. Do you believe there are any wars of aggression that are happening as we speak?
Would you accept Iraq Part 3, it's one of those wars. We're sending more boots on the ground, so to speak, into Iraq as we speak here. Hmm. Last time I checked, there were 6,000 boots on the ground. Now, assuming that each one of our armed forces has 2 feet, then that means 3,000 actual soldiers. And there are more coming. Another 1,000 were announced just last week or so. So, yeah, we're involved in that situation where we probably should leave those people to to their own devices rather than get embroiled in this civil war type thing, in this war between Sunni and Shia. Unfortunately, Bush and Cheney led us into this war, and it's very difficult to extract ourselves without admitting that we were wrong. And how can the sole indispensable country in the world admit it was wrong? I mean, ask you, Paul, does that think, you know, we don't admit we were wrong. We just keep digging the hole further, and, you know, it's going to come, as the Chinese used to say, it's going to come to a no good end. And the earlier we recognize that, the earlier we pull back and let those folks sort things out for themselves, the better.
That's quite a sort of note that I wanted to maybe end the conversation with. I know that you work with the Tell the Word, which is part of the Ecumenical Church of Savior. And I wanted just to get a sense of, given your spiritual base, how does your sense of, as you mentioned earlier, morality, inform your act as an activist?
Mm-hmm. Well, I confess to being right out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which, of course, is also the Islamic tradition. I think that the Yahweh of the Hebrew Scriptures and Jesus of the New and the Prophet as well were interested first and foremost in doing justice. And justice, you know, was defined very early on in the pre-Aramaic language of the Hebrew Scriptures. The word was tzedakah, and it denotes, this is not a connotation or something it refers to, it denotes, quote, showing mercy to the poor, end quote. So what I believe is that the justice that we advertise in our country, where we have this two scales, why is she blindfolded? Well, so she can't show partiality to one or the other scale. Well, that's not biblical. That's not my faith tradition. My faith tradition for justice is a figure with a totally mercy to the poor, showing preference to the poor, as some Christian religious have described it as the preferential option for the poor. If you're a follower of Jesus of Nazareth, as I try to be, it's not an option, okay? The preferential option for the poor, a nice way of putting it, but rock solid at the bottom, it's not an option. That's what you do. You try to lift people up, and you try not to kill them, you try not to drone strike them, you try not to dehumanize them or make them subhuman so you can steal their natural resources, which I've been kind of fixed on for many, many decades now. It was part of why I wanted to work as an analyst in the CIA, believe it or not, because you can't have justice without truth. And when you look at the Washington Post today, you find out that most Americans think torture is okay. And why they think it's okay? Because they've been deprived of the truth. So maybe this is a good time for me to put in what I always put into every speech or interview, and that is that being around Washington for 51 years now, after I left my native New York, being here for 51 years, you see a lot of change, right? A lot of change. But there's one change that dwarfs all the other changes in importance, and that change is that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. That is big. That couldn't be bigger. So what am I saying? I'm saying that people like Dick Cheney, people like George Tenet and George Bush, and all those arguably war criminals, they are depending on American people not to read the report that the Senate put out. It's 500 pages. It's sort of daunting. All they have to do is read a couple of pages and they'll see the heinous activities that were approved for these people to carry out. So they're counting on people getting their news from Fox News or whatever they watch. They're all pretty much the same. Fox is the most egregious. But if you take last Sunday, for example, when this was topic A of the conversation, most of the people who were interviewed, a distinct majority, were people who criticized the report, thought torture could be okay in certain circumstances. Why? Because it works. Now, does it work? It doesn't. That's what the report says. And so what I'm saying here is that if you want to pursue justice, you have to have truth. And these days, truth is a real hard-to-acquire commodity because of the way that media is controlled by the very corporations that profiteer on the war. I don't say profit. I say profiteer on war-making. So what we need to do, I think, is to get the word out. We've been, well, one article I wrote, I think I enumerated all the people that I always say yes if I have time for an interview. Witness the fact that it's getting pretty early in the morning here right now, but I'm still awake, sort of.
And I really appreciate that.
No, not at all. But, you know, as soon as the report came out, I happened to be up in New York. I had a judicial proceeding that I had to be at on the 8th of December. So on the night the report came out, immediately Canadian television called me. Sky News, British TV called me. Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera in Arabic, Al Jazeera America, RT, Russian television, Central China TV, New Zealand radio, Scottish radio. You're getting my point, I hope.
Not one.
U.S. media. CNN? Forget about it. You know, C-SPAN, no. Any of these folks? None of them. And I checked with some of my colleagues, and they had exactly the same experience, even though we had put out a press release that morning, because we knew the report was coming out, declaring our availability for interviews and stating our credentials in terms of our experience with all these intelligence matters. So what I'm saying in a long-winded kind of way is that the American people have been malnourished on real information. And the fourth estate, so-called, you know, the mainstream media, is dead. It's not moribund. It's dead. Now, what's the good news? Well, the good news is that there's a fifth estate. And that fifth estate is really, really hard to control. It's in the ether. It's called the Internet or the Web or whatever you call it. And the young people, that's where they get their news. And so the challenge becomes how to steer people, how to make sure that everyone watches Amy Goodman every morning. That's what I always recommend at the end of my lectures, because she is just terrific and so unique. And when you look at how she, how Democracy Now! Compares to, you know, the NewsHour or some of these other pretentious programs that don't tell you anything, well, enough said on that. But that's the key, in my view. You need to have people explain, for example, what's in this report. Now, if, let's say, most of the Americans polled in these recent pollings that showed most of them favor torture, if they were required to read just 5 pages of the Senate Intelligence Report, the results would be completely different. Completely different. But people don't read. People watch TV. And as I say, the TV, even before Iraq, when we knew, we intelligence officers knew that it was a fool's errand, number one, and that it was being, quote, justified, end quote, by spurious intelligence, we couldn't get anywhere near the Sunday talk show. So that's the problem. That's the challenge. I'm hopeful that, I don't know, I'm hopeful that somebody, maybe someone will call you up, Paulette, and tell us how to do this thing. But it's really hard to figure out a way to get our message out in a way that the normal American, you know, who has a couple of kids and a couple of jobs, most of them, and go home and cook dinner and get the kids to do their homework and put their feet up. And what do? They're not going to, most of them are not going to go on the computer. They're going to watch Fox News and not get the straight story. So that's the challenge. And in terms of my faith tradition, well, I guess I've said that I think truth is necessary to do justice. And that's why I spend, well, I've spent the last 25 years at least trying to spread some truth around to the degree I can. And again, I go anywhere I feel like I can. If there is a group that is interested in hearing what I think and what I can share out of my own experience of 30 years total in the Army, 2+, in the agency, 27+. And you learn a lot of stuff in those kinds of years. And so I have a certain credibility, and thank goodness some people think that I may have learned something, and so I'm willing to share that in any place where people are interested.
Well, I can say that in terms of a possible solution, and I'm not sort of being flippant, is to have more of these kinds of discussions. Mm-hmm. So that we know that the Pacifica affiliates in the U.S. may be picking this up. You know, we put this on radioforall.net, and other mm-hmm. stations pick it up throughout the country. And so the more that we discuss this and perhaps deconstruct as time goes on what's mm-hmm. in this report, that may be a way of spreading the information that you're speaking about.
Yeah. You know, Paulette, on the Friday after the report, so that would be, what, the 8th, 9th, something like the 13th or so, up in New York, WBAI did have myself and, let's see, Marcy Wheeler and, what's his name, a fellow who was actually an interrogator for the CIA, and we had a 20-minute discussion that got to the essence of these issues. And I thought, you know, wow, you know, if that could get out and about in a way that even if people just driving in their cars, they get on the radio, that would be really worth a thousand words. Carl is the name of the other gentleman. I don't know him personally, but he's written a book about the interrogation. And what he ended up saying was that there was no guidance in the beginning. He was out there in the field. He had a detainee, they call it these days. In the old Army, we used to call them prisoners. And he was looking for instructions. And you know what the instructions he finally got were?
What?
Do what you have to do.
Wow.
We need the information. Do what you have to do.
Hmm.
Isn't that something? Then he realized he had to quit, that he couldn't abide by that kind of thing. So, so we can talk about, you know, whether you can get information that way and what kind of information, if you'd like to get into that.
Sure, very much so. How does one get that kind of information? I mean, please expand on what you're saying.
Yeah, I usually start by quoting the head of Army Intelligence and what he said on the same day that George Bush was going to announce how wonderful these enhanced interrogation techniques are. Have I already said that? Because if not, I'll start that way again. General Kimmins?
No.
Okay, good. it's early in the morning and I've talked to so many people today that I lose track.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is really important, and it made me proud to be an Army intelligence officer, frankly. One of the few times I could be proud during all this imbroglio. What happened was this. Dana Priest of the Washington Post had uncovered the fact that there were secret prisons scattered around the world. She didn't name the countries, but we've since known that there were Poland and Lithuania. They were Thailand and Afghanistan. There was another Baltic Republic, let's see, Lithuania, Poland. Bulgaria is not Baltic, but there was another one of those new European countries. So those are five right there. So that was all revealed in a major, major coup piece there by Dana Priest in the Washington Post. So by and by, people got wind of the fact that the CIA was kidnapping people, that they were rendering them, fancy word for kidnapping, extraordinarily rendering them to other places, these black sites in the countries I mentioned. Now, how many countries in the world do you think would have allowed the CIA to do that, to go through their airspace, use their airports, turn a blind eye to these flights that went into Poland and Lithuania and Bulgaria and Thailand and a couple other countries? How many countries in the whole world do you think would have aided and abetted that? I have the answer here. I'm just a, you know. Okay. But let me tell you what the answer is.
All right.
54.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I'm not surprised at that number, because as I have sort of a background working with the international governmental organizations, and somewhat of a sense of how some of these agreements work, where it's a quid pro quo relationship with governments, where you give them something and they give you something in return. And sometimes that includes having access to these spots in their country, or them allowing you to fly in their airspace, or all sorts of other things, and votes and so forth.
Yeah, and often it takes the form of money, right?
Yes, certainly.
And sometimes it's not given to the government, but to the particular government security officials who put the money in their pocket and have power to wave the planes on through. Anyhow, it was 54, and I don't have perhaps all the experience you've had, Paul. I was really shocked. You know, 54 countries out of how many? What, 200 countries in the world? My God. And the U.S. has that power, economic and other power, ties with all manner of intelligence services in these countries. So, anyhow, that's where it was. Now, George Bush said he was going to make a speech, sort of press conference and speech, on the 6th of September 2006, after the cat was out of the bag about what we were doing. Enhanced interrogation techniques had not been coined yet, but people were talking about procedures to be used against terrorists and so forth. Well, what happened earlier that day were two things. Number one, the CIA went to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and told them about all this for the first time. Now, how I know that? Dianne Feinstein has said that. So on the morning of September 6th, in the afternoon of which Bush was going to advertise and defend these enhanced interrogation techniques, that was the first time. First time that the Senate Intelligence Committee was briefed by the CIA on what they had been doing. Now, the real story is this, and this is the one that makes me proud to have been an Army intelligence officer. Across the river, Lieutenant General John Kimmons learned what was going to happen at the White House that afternoon, so he arranged his own press conference across the river, across the Potomac, at the Pentagon. And he arranged that for the morning. So you might say there was a preemptive attack, so to speak. Well, what did Kimmons say? He said this, and I quote, "No good intelligence is ever going to come from abusive practices, period. History shows that. And the experience, the empirical experience of the last 5 years, hard years, also demonstrates that, period, end quote." Okay, in other words, no good, reliable intelligence is ever going to come from abusive techniques such as our president is about to announce this afternoon. Pretty gutsy guy, huh? Pretty gutsy. I was surprised that the Army were able to was able to defend them and keep them in place for a while. So that's the reality, okay? Now, who are you going to believe? General John Kimmins, who spent his whole life in Army intelligence, mostly, incidentally, on interrogation tactics and so forth? Or are you going to believe Dick Cheney or George Bush? And George Bush gets up and he says, we've developed an alternative set of procedures, and this was quickly called enhanced interrogation techniques, and he bragged about how effective they were and all this stuff. Well, Kimmins had done his job. He not only had told the president, but he wanted to tell the people of this country. Now, had you heard about what Kimmins said that day, Paulette?
No, I have not.
Yeah. Please. Surprise, surprise. The press missed that. Yeah. Did they miss it? No, they didn't miss it. They were there. It was a big press conference. So that's just another little indication here. If the American people knew at that time, or even now, that that's what Kimmins said, then what would they be asking? Well, hello, if it doesn't yield reliable intelligence, then why would we do it? And, you know, there's sort of a sensible human reasoning here. Everyone knows if someone is inflicting pain on them, they're going to do whatever they can to stop them, right? So they're going to tell people what they think they want to hear, or they'll tell them anything to stop the pain. That's the way not only human animals, but all kinds of animals will act, right? So it's just practical common sense that torture does not give reliable information. So how about this question? Why would they do it anyway? Well, aside from pure sadism, aside from the desire to show who's in charge and that we are not only the sole indispensable country in the world, but one that's beyond the human laws of nature and humanity, besides all that, is this calculation. And I hope that people listen to this because it's important. We can't get reliable information from torture, but if it's unreliable information you want, man, torture works like a charm. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, even before the war against Iraq, there were these notional weapons of mass destruction, right? We knew that there weren't any, and we said so. Everybody else, the press and everybody, bought the government line that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons and was embarked on a nuclear weapons program that could yield a nuclear bomb right soon. That's what Dick Cheney said on August 26, 2002, and that's what the intelligence people bought into, to their great discredit, in the estimate they did, dated October 1st. So what they said was Saddam Hussein of all kinds of weapons of mass destruction, number one, and number two, and here's what's relevant here, he's actively supported and supported by Al-Qaeda. Now, all Americans knew that 9/11 was blamed on Al-Qaeda, and so the trick was, since we wanted to attack Iraq, to associate Saddam Hussein and Baghdad and Iraq with Al-Qaeda. Now, how are they going to do that? Torture works. Now, they'll tell you what happens. This is not hypothetical or something, you know, out of my imagination. There was a fellow named Al-Libi, okay? Now, he was a Libyan, and he was captured early on, and it was found out that he was sort of like a travel agent for Al-Qaeda. So he was, you know, a real part of the staff there at Al-Qaeda, but all he did pretty much was, buy the plane tickets or train tickets or whatever to get operatives here and there. And when the U.S. Army found this fella, and the CIA said, oh, he could be a gold mine. I hope he'll be able to tell us about the close ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And so they interrogated him. And they said, tell us, How many people you bought tickets for to go up to Baghdad to be trained in these weapons of mass destruction? And Al-Levy said, I beg your pardon? And he said, well, tell us about all the people you sent up to Baghdad to get trained. Oh, I didn't send up. Well, you know, that was not the answer they wanted. And so they applied enhanced interrogation techniques. And they got Al-Levy to say, well, maybe I sent up a couple people. Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but maybe I sent some people up there, but I don't. So they sent them to the Egyptians. Now, Paulette, the Egyptian intelligence people have more experience than U.S. intelligence in enhanced interrogation techniques. And guess what they got him to confess, in quotes, of course? He confessed that he sent all manner of people up to Baghdad to get trained in chemical and biological weapons and explosives. They even briefed them on their nuclear program. It was proof positive, lusted after by the folks that wanted to make war on Iraq, that they could use to do that. And so this is what happened. On the 7th of October, just days after this report on this interrogation by the Egyptians came in, George W. Bush got up before the American people and said, we now have conclusive proof that Al-Qaeda is in league with Saddam Hussein. He's training them in chemical and biological weapons. We have a source that has intimate knowledge of that. And Paulette, that was 3 and 4 days. That is 3 days before the House voted for war, 4 days before the Senate also voted for giving the president authority to wage war in Iraq. I have never seen anything quite so cynical as to use this information gained from torture, very, very useful information, but very unreliable information because of how it was gained, used to justify deceiving Congress, our elected representatives, out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. And so the rest of the story you know. Before Iraq, 69% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. That, of course, was the reason for trying to put a confluence, a kind of a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Donald Rumsfeld, he said the evidence is bulletproof of this operational tie between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And to his credit, the head of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, General Brent Scowcroft, he said, well, I've seen the evidence, and it's very scant. Scant, his word. Well, it was actually non-existent. Saddam Hussein hated Osama bin Laden. The feeling was mutual. You had a clerical zealot against a very secular leader in Saddam Hussein. There was no way. And my colleagues, to their credit, acquitted themselves better on this issue than they did on the weapons of mass destruction, where they sort of gave in to what Dick Cheney wanted to say. On this one, they testified honestly to Congress, and we don't see much in the way of relations between, or even especially not operational ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Footnote here, Larry Wilkerson, the chief of staff to Colin Powell, tells a story about being up in CIA headquarters trying to write a speech for Colin Powell to give at the UN, which he did give on the 5th of February 2003, just before the war. And they had convinced themselves that all this very, very suspect information on operational ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein was a crock, as we would say in the Bronx, okay? It was a crock, all right? Now, they went into a separate room and had this one-on-one conversation, that is, Colonel Wilkerson and Colin Powell. And they came out saying, they were prepared to say, look, you know, we're not going to let the Secretary of State say that there are operational ties between Iraq and Italy, because the evidence doesn't bear that out. Guess what? George Tenet, head of the CIA, goes out of the room, comes back with a report that, yes, indeed, operatives have been going up to Baghdad from Al-Qaeda, being trained in chemical and biological weapons. And this is hot stuff, reliable source. And guess what? It's the same information that came from Halabi that the president, President George W. Bush, used on October 7th. So even though Halabi had confessed, I mean, first he confessed to this erroneous story, but then somehow he got free, and they asked him, well, you know, what do you think? And he said, hey, look, this is, you know, I said all that just to get him to stop torturing me, for God's sake. And I'm, hello, if he torture you, you're going to say anything. And so that was all known, but it was not known to Larry Wilkerson and Colin Powell. And very cynically, George Tenet and John McLaughlin, his deputy, persuaded Colin Powell that, yeah, this evidence was golden. And Powell ended up, I don't know if you remember, but he ended up using the phrase, quote, sinister nexus, end quote. So he said there was this sinister nexus between Al-Qaeda, the perpetrators of 9/11, and Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein could easily give Al-Qaeda weapons of mass destruction. And so I think I've already said 69% of the people in the U.S. believe that there was this relationship, and more important, believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, and that unless we attacked him and defeated him and decapitated him, then, you know, there would be no rest for us. There would be 9/11 after 9/11. So that's how cynical it was. That's how intelligence gained from harsh interrogation techniques can be very useful for adducing unreliable information or information that you want people to say, and so you torture them until they say it. Little footnote here, what happened to Libby? Well, we had a very close relationship with the Libyan intelligence service at the time. And Halabi, poor fella, winds up in a Libyan prison. Now, a year or two later, a U.S. Civil Liberties group is visiting prisons, and oh, they find Halabi right there in that prison in Libya. And guess what? A day or two after, Halabi, quote, commits suicide, end quote. Now, Halabi happened to be a devout Muslim. Devout Muslims don't generally commit suicide. And when they gave his body back to his next of kin, the experience was the same as many other Libyan families that got their dead suicide victims back. All kinds of marks of torture in the back, and strong suspicions that on lots of reasons, religious as well as physical, that this was hardly a suicide. And the coincidence in timing, he just having been discovered by a human rights organization, that tells me that the Libyans got the word to make sure that Halabi did not live to tell the real story about all this. So, is this cynical? Is this, you know, I sometimes chuckle, you know, George Bush, when he started talking about evildoers. Evildoers, we got to get the evildoers. I thought, you know, who uses words like that in the modern day, you know? But you know what? I have to say that I don't think people are evil. But certainly what George W. Bush and what Dick Cheney did was evil. And they need to be held accountable for it, or you can have people thinking that they will be inured, that they would be immune from prosecution if they have enough power to follow that example.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for that, and I I was actually going to ask, you know, what the international implications are, you know, and you just answered me that as long as people see that certain actions can go unchallenged, they'll be led to believe that anyone can do the same thing and get the same result.
Yeah, it's you know, it's very simple. If these things are allowed to happen and nobody's held accountable, then that's the best way to ensure that it will indeed happen again.
Mm. Well, thank you, and I wanted just to close out the conversation. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Well, yeah. I want to appeal to folks, and you know, Pacifica Radio is great. I've been on, this is the fourth station I've been on for in the last couple of days. You know, one of my heroes is Cesar Chavez, and he used to say, thanks for those op-eds and those speeches. They're really, really good. But you know what? Without action, nothing's going to happen. And people keep telling me, says Cesar, there aren't enough of us. There aren't. We have to build more people. He said, there are enough of us. There already are enough of us, okay? But without action, nothing's going to happen. Now, what does this mean in practicality? Well, Dr. King famously said, there is such a thing as too late. What has been happening abroad, and even more important, what's been happening to our civil liberties here in the United States, is very similar to what happened in the 1930s in Germany. In Germany, the people kind of waited until it was too late. And the churches and the other religious institutions, mostly the churches were Catholic and Lutheran. Well, what about them? In these times, you tend to look to institutions that have some pretensions to moral authority, correct? Well, those churches could not find their voice. They said nothing. Matter of fact, some people don't know this, but the first thing Hitler did when he came into power, absolute power pretty much, was to make sure that there was a pastor in every church in Germany. Now, you know, some of the parishes without a pastor, the pastor studying in a seminary, something like that. Well, he insisted that there be a pastor in every one of those parishes. And why do you suppose he did that? Because he thought that would be a factor of stability for his regime, and sorrowfully, it was. So, with very few exceptions, D.C. Bonhoeffer, for one, and others, they didn't find their voice, they didn't say anything, and then it was too late. And maybe I'll just finish up with a real story about one fellow who went along with what was going on because he was studying for his doctorate and tenure at the University of Berlin. His name was Haushofer, and he was at Gale Walk. Okay, he was a geologist there, and he had tenure. A lot of people may be listening into this and know what tenure means. And you know, he had a mate. And then he watched his Jewish friends and his Gypsy friends, and he saw all kinds of political activists being rounded up and sent off to concentration camps. And Albrecht Haushofer thought, well, you know, there's some things more important than tenure. Started speaking out, and he rallied quite a group of people who were viewed on by Hitler, of course, and the SS as subversive. So he got wrapped up, and he got thrown in a Berlin prison, a different one from the one that Bonhoeffer ended up in. But there he is in prison, and it's early 1945. The Allies are advancing, And what they did with these people, they had two methods of execution. One was to shoot them, and the other one was to hang them. Bonhoeffer was hanged, and they had execution by shooting ready for Haushofer. But the SS is very, very meticulous in typical German fashion, and they insisted that each one of these people to be executed write and sign a confession before they were executed. and Haushofer said that that's not something I'm not going to do any confession. And so with the Allies coming a couple miles away, they shot him. Okay, and as they picked him up from the platform there, a little scrap of paper came out from his pocket. It was his confession. It was written in the form of a sonnet. And it's very brief. If we have time, take a minute or so to recite it for you.
Of course.
Okay. The title he gave it was Schuld, the German word for guilt. Okay. And what he said was this, or what he wrote was this. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Okay, yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Ich musste schärfer Unheil nennen. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. Okay, I should have earlier spoken out. I should have schärfer spoken out more sharply. I put off my Urteil, my judgment, my real views far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, so I did warn, aber nicht genug und klar. Okay, genug is enough. Klar is claro, klar. There's no comparative for klar in German. So, ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today, I recognize what I was guilty of, period, end quote. So my appeal to whoever is listening to this is to recognize that not only Haushofer, but Dr. King had it exactly right. There is such a time, there is such a thing as too late. And what we need to do is figure out a way to stop this machine. And it may require us putting our bodies into it. And if that's the case, there are enough of us. As Cesar says, there are enough of us, but nothing's going to happen without action. Maybe I'll end it there. I appeal to you. Act.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We so appreciate your being with us this morning.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Paulette, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Just on the last note, how might our audience follow your work?
Oh, I always forget that. And my son created a website for me, and he gets very angry if I do an interview like this and forget to mention the website. It's very easy. It's raymcgovern.com, and that's all you need to do. Put on your URL line, and it's not a fancy one, but he does post my articles, my interviews. If you send me a link, I'll try to put this interview up on it. Mm-hmm. My little 3-minute, I was going to say debate. It was more like an argument with the former head of the House Intelligence Committee, Hoekstra. That is up there on that on my website, and it's that suggests it's really kind of interesting to watch because it's a very rare instance where on a live panel people were able to raise questions directly to the fellow 2 inches away from him and get into what really was an argument rather than discussion, but I think a really instructive and enlightening one.
I did watch it and it was quite powerful. And thank you again. I truly appreciate your making the time to be with us live. And
well, You're most welcome, Paulette. And again, good luck with your program, and perhaps we'll see each other again.
I hope so. And I wish you well.
Okay. Goodbye now.
Bye.
You're listening to Freedom Cry by Deep Forest, and that was a live interview with Paulette Spencer and Ray McGovern. I want to thank you, Paulette. That was really fabulous. You did a, you know, really great interview. I enjoyed it, and a lot of inspiration there to get moving, get something done with ourselves, with our lives, with this world. And I like the fact that he's impeccable. Really impeccable in his standards and his morality. He's got a strong spiritual base.
Very much so.
And his advice was really excellent. And it also made me very proud of WBAI and Pacifica that we are covering these issues in ways that the mainstream is not. We're just about out of time. We might be able to take a few phone calls, maybe 1 minute each, 2 minutes each, if you want to come in with a rapid-fire comment at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. But otherwise, we'll be here. We'll play a little bit of music, and we are awaiting the upcoming show, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. They're doing a special fracking program with Ken Gale and Jim Freund, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. I believe we do have a phone call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I just heard that interview you did with Ray McGovern there, and I think it's kind of wrong to allow opinions where you basically call on George Bush. You know, the guys like him or not, you know, excuse me, sort of criminal behavior. Without a rebuttal, you know, all the intelligence that was involved, that pointed toward weapons of mass destruction, everything was there. It was there in other communities of the nation, and so on. And you know, the fire intelligence absolutely was well aware. Some of the same absolutely had mass destruction used amongst all people.
I'm having a little difficulty hearing you. Are you saying that there was no rebuttal to McGovern and it was a long interview? Is that actually what you're saying?
Yeah, he was allowed to ramble on, but without...
Ah, yeah. But you're not being allowed to. Okay, let's take another call. That was rude, right? Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I loved Paulette Spencer's interview, and I have been following this even on C-SPAN when it happened way, way back. In those years, I heard Powell talk, and everything that Mr. Ray McGovern had said. The man is, I guess, near in his 70s or so. Mm-hmm. A wonderful interview, and I wanted to tell Catherine Davis how spiritually you were like. You were like Robert Knight, spiritually there in making it okay for the white audience to call in. And I liked your comments last week, and you are perceptive indeed. And indeed, we have been harassed by these callers for Altonmatics.
Yeah, but I don't want to go there.
Okay, let's not go there.
You know, because
you're just
taking it right back into that energy, and that's not what it's about.
Thank you so much.
You know, these people have their beliefs, and they have a right to the beliefs, and in many ways, they're correct. It's the perspective of how sometimes things are delivered that I want to object to. It's not that people have strong opinions.
Absolutely. And you know what? The thing is, too, that I liked hearing Alton Maddox with Earl Caldwell. But the thing is, why doesn't he just come up here free of charge? Maybe he wants to get paid.
No, I don't think that's it at all. And you're taking it in a direction that I'm not going to go. Sorry. And it's not about race. It's about respect. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm actually, let me turn the phone off. I was really impressed with what Mr. McGovern said.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another book that's written by another professor, Torture and Impunity. It's called The U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. It was written in 2008 by this professor, Alfred McCoy. And he talks about CIA using black sites. And not just how Bush used the theater of state of terror, but how Obama administration right now is giving them cover, the torturers, giving them impunity. And it's a great book. It's 371 pages. I usually don't call in. This is my first time. But I read it about 3 weeks ago. And then the report came out, and I'm reading the redacted version of the PDF document. And if anybody wants to, like, read the real stuff, it's written by this guy, and he spells it all out, how the constitutional rights of all these people were violated, and how the counterinsurgency used torture as a crucible.
And what was the name of the book again?
Very simple. Torture and Impunity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me spell impunity, I-M-P-U-N-I-T-Y. That basically means that you're immune to prosecution.
Exactly.
And he goes into the Bybee memo, which says torture is only torture when it's organ failure. I mean, it's some, the ethics of torture, the history of torture, how America trained guys in South America. I mean, the whole history.
Yeah, there was the School of the Americas in which they trained all of the death squads.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, this country has a long history of this behavior, and I can see why they're so desperate at the top to stay in control, because should America lose its dominance, there I can see a lot of people going to jail. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you so much, and please, if you can get a copy of the book, read it. It lists all the guys and names and everything.
I'll look for it. Thank you. And we have to make room for the next show. We do have a few more calls coming in. If you can be rapid fire fast, maybe we can get two more calls in. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes.
Rick, the Bronx.
Yes, Rick.
Quote, violence is as American as apple pie. Thanks, bye.
Well, can't argue with that. All right, well, I guess we're out of time. Paulette, thank you for being here with me this evening.
My pleasure.
On this program, and I think that I think that was a stellar interview, and I enjoyed it immensely.
So did I.
And we're going to play a little bit of music. I'm going to go to The Doors. See what this sounds like. It's called The Spy.
I'm a spy.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Coming up next is Hour of the Wolf, and this is Ken Gale subbing for Jim Freund. And we just had a great political victory today, and that's what we'll be talking about. So stay tuned.
Texting on a bridge without a guardrail. It's a train with no conductor.
And that was the Hayride Casualties with their Natural Gas song. And I'm really kind of surprised that I'm doing a show like this. Normally when Jim Freund asked me to sub for Hour of the Wolf, I talk about comic books and science fiction. Something I'm into and something I know something about, and fist Jim's audience. And I asked, but today, at about 1:30 or so, the governor of New York announced that there was going to be a permanent ban on fracking. It's going to be extended. And, of course, fractivists have been working on this issue for years and years and years. And a victory so hard fought is something to celebrate. And Jim felt, why not celebrate it? And I have with me... Kevin, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Kevin O'Neill. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you, Ken, on this historic day. It's a little after my bedtime, but wow, what an amazing opportunity! I hope I can help help get people excited about this incredible story if they're not already aware of it.
Why don't you go into detail about that while I get that little video that you showed me?
Oh yeah, well, you know, I work in the renewable energy business and the solar business up in Westchester, and I was actually getting a tire fix when I got a phone call from a woman, Michelle Solomon, who works in the Rockland Coalition Against Fracking, and she was just breaking the news to me. I mean, in the morning, I had been talking about, I had been posting on Facebook about. You know, the inside scoop was that Governor Cuomo was likely to approve some test wells, and that was getting a lot of people panic-stricken. So it was just a tremendous relief to hear that our governor had taken the stance that he did today. And I haven't had a chance to really follow a lot of the news because I was working full-time at that time, so... You know, I'm learning, as it breaks for a lot of other people at the same time.
I know when I was getting the emails all day that people thought, oh, he's going to announce which counties are being sacrificed and things like that. And when I saw the news on an email, my first thought was, this is how cynical I am. Somebody was being overly optimistic. And, I really thought that, Cuomo said something that was, you know, kind of wishy-washy, and you could take it either way, and somebody was taking it in the best possible way. And that's not what happened. The health department announced that they recommended a ban on fracking, and the governor announced that he was taking up that ban, and it really happened. And I'm still somewhat amazed. I really am. And we have another guest about to join us. So while I bring them in, let's play the music about... this would be much more fitting if I play this music, except the darn computer is not responding. Nope. All right. Bear with me this all night, overnight, live radio.
Hello. Please.
Hello.
Hello.
So all right. Our second guest has arrived. Sit next to Kevin, Donna. Oh. So I can look at both of you.
What a night, huh? What a day. It's good to see you, Donna.
So I was just talking about how cynical I was and not believing that we actually won. and thinking somebody was being overly optimistic. And then, of course, the emails started coming in fast and furious from a lot of different people. And I realized this was real. And now, Donna, you were there, weren't you?
Where's there? I was lots of places.
Yeah. Where are you coming from?
I went
Well, thank you. I went to the victory party at Cuomo's New York City place. I'm telling you, we had a large group of people.
Is this the 4 o'clock or the 6 o'clock? Like, what time was it?
Four. So it was over at 5.
Right.
And
I so wanted to get to that.
Yeah.
I left it about 20 to 5.
That's the broadcast that I just showed you out in the lobby by Sabrina Artel. An amazing piece of footage.
That was my train of sight, so she must have been right on my left shoulder.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. Have you seen it yet? Have you bought it?
Yeah, of course. Of course, I look for myself.
I hope Ken can get the technology together and share that with the audience.
The Cuomo came down at that point. That's where the footage was. But before that, everybody was just chanting. Al Appleton was there, my hero.
Oh.
It was because of Al Appleton 6-7 years ago. I went to a meeting that Ken Gale told me to go to to hear about this thing called fracking. And it was like, whoa. From that point forward, New York City Friends of Clearwater, which I'm part of, was on it and talking about it and telling lots of people about it. And it was great. He was dynamic. He's intelligent. Go to YouTube. And
great voice, too. The guy has just a lovely voice.
Go Al Appleton. Yeah, he was the ex-commissioner of DEC.
I snuck a recording of his whole thing and I broadcast it on YouTube. Of a whole thing he did about fracking in New York State. He said there's not going to be fracking in New York State. And his argument was it's a landscape problem. And I was like, what a novel approach. Said it's a landscape problem. It's not going to happen. And like, I believed that, but I didn't really believe it. It wasn't enough. But it turned out,
Hey, wishing sometimes worked. Does make it so. Yoo-hoo.
Was Tony Avallo out? I heard somebody mention he was somewhere, and he was inspiring. I mean, his politics, I don't understand the whole scene, but he was so inspiring to the audience. I did a day of fracking or whatever, that day of lobbying up in Albany. And he really spoke, gave a lot of heartfelt encouragement to a lot of people.
And I've got that video up, and now I got to the little rally, the celebration rally in front of Cuomo's office, and for me, there wasn't enough credit to the people who bird-dogged Cuomo all these years, and everybody kept saying, oh, it was thanks to Cuomo that we got this ban. It's like, no, it's thanks to us that we got this ban. It was... The environmental activists of New York State and just outside the state, because certainly the people in Pennsylvania who have had their water poisoned, helped us out a lot.
Well, yeah, we have to realize, yes, we can thank Cuomo, but he's not doing this because he's a nice guy. He's doing this because we put people pressure on him. We still have to be aware that there is more to do. This is just fracking in New York State. This is huge. But there is still fracking gas coming into New York from other states. There is still infrastructure being built. Did you ever see anything being built that wasn't used? We still have to stop the pipelines. We still have to stop LNG port. Port Ambrose, point of information. Liberty gave Cuomo $25,000 for his campaign. We got
$25,000? Wait, it must have been more than that.
I know, right? Doesn't sound like enough. We have to get more information than that. But we have to realize that, hey, he's got people he's got to answer to. I mean, he's a politician, right?
Yeah.
So we've got to be aware that there's still a fight to happen. We've got to stop Seneca Lake. We are SenecaLake.com is a good site to go to get more information.
What's
about
Seneca
Lake? Seneca Lake, they're going to have these precious natural salt